is Hard Parking, brought to you by Right Honda, Right Toyota, out of Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm your host, Jay Finney, recording to you from Lisbon, Portugal. That's right. Coming up on today's episode, Tim McGrain of the M1 Concourse. A couple weeks ago when I was in Long Beach, I ran into Tim randomly. I go, hey, what's your name? I'm Tim McGrain. I go, oh, you were on my podcast like 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So I'm playing this as a classic because I loaded my hard drive up before I went on vacation and I grabbed the wrong hard drive. So, set for a classic. Anyway, coming up after this work from 4Wheel Online, Tim McGrain.
For over a decade, 4Wheel Online has been bringing the best truck accessories and truck parts to enhance the appearance and performance of all trucks and SUVs. They are dedicated to providing an extensive range of upgrades that will match any maker model on the road. Their truck products cover everything to give your truck a custom look and added functionality. Need a wheel and tire package? Head over and use the configuration tool. They carry all the major brands of wheels and tires, so go get outfitted today. Visit them online at 4Wheel Online. Tim McGrain, welcome to the Hard Parking Podcast.
Jay, thank you.
Of course, thanks for taking the time. So this year we have the Woodward Dream Cruise, and they do that every year. I lived there in the area, sort of, but I never made it to that event. You've done a lot of stuff, and we'll get into some of that here in a few minutes. Have you ever been to the Woodward Dream Cruise?
I have not. This year is going to be my first time experiencing it as someone who's lived on the West Coast, and for the better part of nearly three decades, I've been actively involved in one form or another with the events that happen on the Monterey Peninsula, whether they be auctions in my early years, the Pebble Beach Concours for a long period of time, most recently Laguna Seca and the Monterey Historics. So I've heard a lot about it. Certainly, I think I have a full understanding of what the Woodward Dream Cruise culture is all about, but this will be my first year.
Oh, yeah. It's a different animal from what I understand, especially coming from where you just came from. And for people who normally listen to this podcast, they know that I love Monterey Car Week. Love Monterey Car Week and been up to the Laguna and the Historics. And when I try to explain to people what it is or what they can see, they're in disbelief that, like, no way, like, somebody's racing that. I said, yeah, you have no idea what era you're in, because they take that very expensive car and they put it on that track and they go, you know, they're not driving around on parade laps.
Yeah. What you see on the roads there, and not that they necessarily all comply with California DMV, but that particular week, there's sort of an accepted sort of grace period of, you know, as long as you behave yourself, you can push the boundaries of what's on the road. So you do see some fabulous machinery on the road.
Absolutely. So for my listeners, can you kind of tell them a little bit about yourself?
So I grew up in Kent, Southeast England. I was probably within earshot of Brands Hatch Racetrack, which in England was one of the two racetracks at that time that would host Formula One Grand Prix. They would alternate years to year. So as a young kid, we would go out to Brands Hatch basically for any reason we could think of. We'd cycle out there, and whether it was, you know, at one end of the extreme, you know, go-karts and saloon cars, and then motorcycles and Formula One races, whether it's the Grand Prix, or they used to have what they called non-championship Formula One races back in those days. So there was an event called the Race of Champions. And motorcycles, I think, were an early passion of ours, because we could all imagine ourselves being, you know, Mike Hailwood or Agostini or Phil Reed on our bicycles riding around the neighborhood.
That last comment makes me wonder. I wonder if children today, because life evolves and the things that people are into evolve so much, and some of those memories, like, those are some of the best memories. You're riding on your bike and you are somebody, or you're in your little car or whatever, and you're pretending like you're somebody. I wonder what kids these days look forward to.
You know, bikes don't have spokes anymore. I mean, so it's been a long time since you've heard the playing card on the rear wheel. You know? Right. Anyway, so I grew up there. Has always had sort of a passion for cars from an early age. I can't necessarily tell you know, where that came from.
Sure.
But when I say an early age, I've got some pictures which I cherish, which I don't know whether my parents or my grandparents took. It was at my grandparents' house, and there's a picture of me and my fifth birthday, and I was given an Austin J40 pedal car, which is sort of the iconic British pedal car. Most people see them now. They're the pedal car that's used when they do the race at the Goodwood Revival pedal car races down the straight. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're most notable. It's also made why they're very difficult to get hold of at affordable prices. And anyway, I had one of those my fifth birthday. So I'm thinking that I probably was into cars at an early age, because if I was into soccer, I'd probably be standing there with a soccer ball under my arm.
Sure.
But anyway, so cars were something that was around. Lots of friends, you know, either into custom cars and hot rods. We got American cars when we were young. My dad was a car dealer. He had a used car dealership. It was a business to him.
Right.
It wasn't a passion. He had formerly been a professional soccer player. That was at a time when you needed a real job to live, because soccer mm-hmm. didn't pay you enough. So soccer was his passion, and also golf. He golfed a lot. I wasn't into golf. Golf didn't appeal to me at all. And the schools I went to, we weren't allowed to play soccer. So that really wasn't a big passion of mine. So it was all about cars. But obviously, you're going down to hanging out at his where he worked, or his business. They would let me, you know, I take cars out into the sort of the back area, back compound, and I could parallel park and 3-point turn and reverse a car into a space, you know, long before anybody would ever think about giving me a driver's license. So I spent that served me well. I'd sit there, and some of those early British cars had lots of switches. The old Jaguar sedans had, you know, these banks of toggle switches on the dash. I'd sit there playing with the wheel and turning these switches on and off. And I do remember I probably left the lights on a couple of times and got into a whole bunch of trouble with the dead battery the next day.
Going back to your J40 real quick, because I heard you mention that on another podcast. At one point in time, you were still trying to find one at an auction. Did you ever find one?
Yes, I didn't. My wife did. My lovely wife. Okay. So I had come across them. I used to go to Hershey each year mm-hmm. for a number of years, and you'd find them there. And they would be project cases.
Right.
And you go like, oh, you know, I really don't want to take that on. Or the other extreme, you'd find them at an auction, and they would just go for crazy money. And I'm thinking, this is going to end up to be a credential holder. I mean, that's really what he's mm-hmm. going to do. He's going to sit there, and I'm going to relive, you know, my youth. But that's so it wasn't something that I kept looking around just in case. And then the appeal of Goodwood just drove them up. So we were at the Pebble Beach Concours one year. My wife and I were at a cocktail reception. And talking to actually somebody I knew for a long time from the Seattle area who had a big automobilia collection. And he excused himself to sort of go to the restroom. And while he was gone, Cindy said, you think Gordon's got an Austin J40? And I'm saying, he won't have an Austin J40. They're mostly in England, in Europe. Well, little did I know that she asked him. And he had two, apparently.
Oh, wow.
One restored and one unrestored. And she ended up buying the unrestored one, probably because the restored one was, like most of them, sure. crazy money. And at the time, I was at the Black Hawk Museum, and we were actually having one of our speaker series, and the author, Matt Stone, was there, and he was doing the talk. And one of the staff called to Tim, the chap trying to deliver a pedal car. And I thought, what's he talking about? And it turned out that Cindy had bought this from Gordon, and Gordon had his driver, he'd lived between Seattle and Scottsdale. His driver was coming through the East San Francisco Bay Area and dropped off the car. So there I was. It was a present. Santa came early. And I have a fear that she probably paid as much for that pedal car as maybe I paid for my first two or three full-size cars. But
sure.
That's all right. It's a great memento. And hey, maybe our granddaughter will take to it in a few years when she gets to five.
So you didn't try to wedge yourself into one by any chance, right?
Oh, no, it's never going to happen.
Right. Let's switch back to the Woodward Dream Cruise. And so this year, the M1 Concourse has an add-on where people can pay for a day, or they could pay for an entire weekend pass. Like, what has the reception been on that? And was that your brainchild, or, you know, is that something you brought? Hey, because it kind of reminds me when I was reading up on it, like this is kind of like a micronized quail in a sense, almost to kind of test the waters to see if Michigan's ready for something like this.
You know, you're not wrong with that sort of mindset. No, I can't take credit for it. The team had done this, you know, before I joined M1. It was actually planned to happen last year, but as with nearly everything in the world, it evaporated as COVID descended upon our lives.
Sure.
So we resurrected it. It's intended to be a complement to the Dream Cruise. Now, you know, I'll try and talk as an authority who's never attended. You know, there's tens of thousands of cars and hundreds of thousands of people that are out here for days along Woodward Avenue between Ferndale in the south and up to Pontiac here. But because there are, you know, some great cars out there, whether they be historic muscle cars, legendary hot rods, or even modern day cars, maybe new builds, you know, SEMA show cars, current, you know, whether you know, roadsters or cars from Autorama, the Riddler Award winners, you know, because of their historical value, I mean, their nature, their value, or the just the owners feeling like, you know, that's just I don't want to go I don't want Woodward Avenue with this car, but they still want to share them. They you know, they enjoy their cars. They want other people to enjoy their cars. So we thought if we created an event, you know, a series of days, this was 3 days that we would do different events all around cars that were part of what the culture of Woodward Avenue or Dream Cruise is. And because we have this controlled environment at the M1 Concourse facility, so we put it together. We also are able to offer some additional amenities. You know, the ticket will include, you know, you'll get food during the day, you'll get beverages, we'll obviously have the necessary facilities. Parking will be accommodate you with parking. Not all of it on site, some of it off site, but with shuttle service. So all those things that maybe some people have found challenging, and maybe a deterrent to go down and do Woodward Avenue, that this will give them an opportunity to come here and enjoy these cars. And again, it's, you know, we're not looking to take anything away from the Dream Cruise, because that's what it, you know, that's what this is all about. But we're on Woodward Avenue. I mean, M1 Concourse took its name from Woodward Avenue's, you know, original Highway 1 designation, you know, Michigan 1 Highway.
Right. And,
you know, actually, from what I understand, there's a certain section of Woodward Avenue was the very first paved highway in North America. So thanks to the honorary Augustus B. Woodward, you know, so we sit right on Woodward Avenue. So it was only natural for us to create something, you know, while such an event was happening with so many cars and so many people. When we first announced it, you know, there certainly was some, you know, some cautiousness about it. You know, this has been traditionally, you know, a free event, you know, unless you're trying to park your car somewhere along Woodward in a parking lot, where it seems to be quite a revenue generating venture for any property owners around the area. So, but I think now people, and we've had an outreach program with car clubs, you know, our team members are going out to the many car events that are now happening now that the weather is nice, whether the weekends or even during the week, and people are really getting engaged with it. And, you know, in the last, you know, 2 weeks, our ticket sales are really taken off. So we think that the people, you know, are seeing this, you know, as a good opportunity, but it's not an alternative in the sense that they can come to our event. So, you know, we've got some car clubs where, you know, maybe they found a place or they have a place, but they can only fit 25 members' cars in, and there could be 50 members. So, they, you know, who gets the, is it the first 25? Is it, you know, okay, Joe, it's your turn this year because you did it last year. So somebody's missing out. Whereas here, you know, we could accommodate if that city, they came to us and say, okay, we've got place for 60 cars, but they can also leave here and go out and cruise Woodward Avenue if they've got a spare 4 hours, which I understand what it takes to get around, you know, a 45-minute drive turns into a four-hour cruise, and come back and their parking space is still there, the space where their club is. So we think that that will be appealing, and it's going to take a while. I mean, truth, it's only been in the last few weeks that, you know, with the people getting vaccinated and most states lifting their regulations, you know, we're now sort of starting to, you know, sort of exhale and go, okay, you know, there is life after this, and we want to go out and enjoy it. So we certainly sense a pent up demand for people who want to go out and enjoy themselves at car events. So we're looking forward to having a very successful event.
I didn't really think about some of these vehicles breaking down or potentially having issues, because I have to believe there was probably been a laid out history of just things that have gone wrong, whether intentional or unintentional, over the years. So now they can park these cars and people can still see them. But for an event that's been so traditional to the entire region, not just Detroit, the community adoption of this, I can imagine what some of the feedback could have been when they first pitched it, or what is still coming in. Like, have you had to see or read or handle any of that stuff?
Well, from our end, is my understanding Pontiac was the last of the, I think it's nine cities that are between Ferndale and Pontiac to formally embrace the cruise. I can't tell you why that was the case. But, you know, some of the cities are obviously very embracing. You know, maybe some of them may look at it, you know, with more challenging vision, depending upon, you know, if you've got long distances between your traffic lights, you know, you end up with, you know, a lot of sort of, you know, stoplight racing. Although it sounds like by the sheer quantity of cars that are out there, you're probably not doing much speed because it just isn't possible. But if you're out there on the road, I mean, you've got people that are cruising, you know, people that are just trying to get somewhere in their normal right. life and probably wondering, you know, what did I get in the middle of here? Trying to take the kids to soccer game or something. I think there's, you know, the organizing committee, you know, obviously, I wouldn't say it's a challenging job, but it's certainly, I take my hats off to them trying to get, again, if it's nine cities to sort of all agree on something, but I think it's probably one of those things, they're coming anyway, we might as well just adopt the program and accommodate them and make sure that we make the most of it. So Pontiac is certainly welcoming. They've created a whole sort of welcoming committee for not only this particular week, because we've got back-to-back events here at M1 Concourse, but then in September when we have back-to-back events with our American Speed Festival preceded by Motobella. So Pontiac is as part of their, you know, sort of transition in bringing Pontiac back from, you know, what obviously are some very challenging times that they've had, really embracing these events. And it's great that we get the support for city, but I think it's just as important for us to do everything we can to make the events that we do here or the events that we're involved in benefit this part of Oakland County and also the city of Pontiac where we can.
Yeah, and one thing to remember, I think that the city has to try to remember, and maybe that's what they have figured out, is it's not just people there. Like, people are coming from everywhere to attend this event, so it's more revenue. But sure, the rest of the stuff is always going to be kind of a headache. People upset because they can't go shopping, and then what do you do with the strip mall people? And so with regard to the vehicles that are going to be in the concourse, and from what I'm reading, they're going to be rotating some of the cars out. Will they be stanchioned off, or will it be like some of the other concourse events where those who are there are able to kind of walk around and hopefully engage in some conversation with some of the vehicle owners?
You know, that is our intention. You know, we've got space here where we can space the cars out. And it's our intention to sort of display the cars so they can be enjoyed. Now, there may always be exceptions to the rule in the sense that one particular car, for whatever reason, you know, the owner may say, you know, if I'm going to bring it out, I really like it to be stanchioned off. And it could be just because the experience is, right. It's just a magnet for somebody to get in it, you right. know. Or for whatever reason. But, you know, if you go to a lot of the, like this weekend, I'm heading down to, you know, Amelia Island. And obviously we've mentioned Pebble Beach and those events and the tremendous cars that they have at those events. And people respect the fact that, yes, they're not stanchioned off, but also that that they don't touch them. You know, they enjoy the cars, but respect the fact that they're available and it's not like a auto show where everything's behind ropes.
And
so that's our intention.
Yeah, and the people that are attending Pebble Beach and the Quail and some of those events, they've paid a ticket to get in, as opposed to, you know, it was Exotics before they moved to Exotics on Broadway, where it's the only wide open free event where you can't really move, and so there's a lot more risk of something going wrong.
Well, that's exactly. There's a concentration, you know, when it was down on Cannery Row, and I haven't seen it on Broadway, but I've heard. But yeah, you've just got so many people in such a little space that you just you got a log jam, and that has a then you just get too many people in an area where the cars that are exposed are potentially being touched or damaged.
Yeah, so it's necessary, and I think it's going to be exciting. I think that people who maybe are against it now because they don't quite understand, or they're not used to saying, okay, well, I can walk up and traditionally look at this thing for free, whereas now, you know, I have to pay if I want to go in there and look at it. This happens all over the place, and especially with some of your history and some of the things that you've been a part of, this is just par for the course. So I want to kind of switch to your history. So you have roots in hospitality. You know, how much do you think that's actually played a part in all the roles that you've held over the years, where hospitality is essentially the fundamental experience skill set, I would imagine, needed to pull off any large event when dealing with people from all walks of life brought together by their love of automobiles? Like, how much do you think that root hospitality experience has helped you?
Well, I think it's been beneficial for me. I was very fortunate when I first came out to the States and lived in California. I work for a restaurateur in Palm Springs, a gentleman by the name of Mel Haber. So he owned a high-end restaurant in an exclusive inn in Palm Springs. He also owned a very popular nightclub at the time. And he was a driving force when it came to taking care of the guests. Now, his business has made a lot of money, and we made a lot of money because we took care of the guests. But that being said, it was all about making sure that, you know, when the guests came, how they were greeted, how they were taken care of, you know, making sure they didn't wait for anything, you know, greeting them, just spending time with them. And he was a taskmaster. You know, people used to say to me, you know, did you learn a lot, you know, from Melvin? I said, well, no. Did he teach you a lot? He's like, no, you just learned. If you didn't learn, you were gone.
Right.
Because it was his business. But mm-hmm. but he was, I mean, and he was around. He passed away just a couple of years ago. But I think anybody in the desert area, if they knew Mel Haber, I mean, he was considered Mr. Hospitality. And I did pick up a lot from that. And I think that was those underlying lessons or skills that I was able to take to some of the other worlds that I went into. I mean, whether it's the classic car auction world or the museum world or events where we're taking care of people, whether they're car events or other events. And, you know, I did some events in, you know, the non-automotive world where we were, you know, taking care of guests or participants that were very wealthy. And you were at a position, you were putting on a great event, but you couldn't outspend these people. You couldn't wow them with, hey, we've got the biggest shrimp you've ever seen, or we've got the most fabulous this, or we've got largest, because in that position, I think they probably owned everything. So we just had to make an impact, and there was no shortage of events. Those people get invited everywhere. So we looked at it this way. We had to make a difference in how we treated these people from the moment they arrived through all their experience. You know, if they, you know, I would say joke with the team. It's like, if they drop something, it doesn't hit the floor. They want a Band-Aid at 2 o'clock in the morning. And this was a 3 or 4 day event in Europe they were doing. So, you know, we're there with that. We'd have 24 hour around the clock, you know, car service. And it was just things like that at that level, but also the car show level. It's like, what is the guest experience going to be? You know, whether they've bought a ticket or entering a car. When I joined Laguna Seca, I went there, and as I had been a guest of Laguna Seca, whether the track management or teams, I'd gone there a lot, and I knew the experience that I'd seen as an attendee. And when I took over, I got the team together, and I said, "This is how we have to approach it." Whether they've driven down from San Francisco and they spent money on a tank of gas, or they've shipped their race team from the other side of the world, they've spent money to be here. And whether it's a sunny day in the summer or a cold, wet day in the winter, it's our responsibility for all these people, media, teams, sponsors, vendors. We have to give them that bucket list day experience. You know, if you don't like motorcycles, then don't volunteer for a motorcycle event. You know, if you get up in the morning and your favorite parking space is taken, that's your problem. But check it when you get out of the car, because that person coming doesn't need to meet a grumpy person, because 100%. They've paid money. They want an experience. And that was that's always been sort of the culture or the approach that I've tried to instill in our team. Because again, if you're paying just a ticket to come to a car show, everybody that you meet along the way, if you're a patron, a guest or whatever, you've got to feel like you're wanted there. And I think that's the underlying approach at every level of the types of events that we do, because it's so easy to moan and groan, and people go, oh my gosh, you know, I got three more hours to go. And then the person comes around the corner, was like, he's like, hey, I'm here. And you go, oh, what do you want? It's like, no, that's right. Not how we do it. So I think, to your original question, I think that the hospitality mindset, you know, has to be part of all the events and activities that we do. And I think that I've been involved with.
Everybody wants to be the VIP, and it's the things that you do, you have to be dealing with that all the time, whether it's somebody you've known at every event from way back or somebody who's brand new that they think that they're the only one who's spent the same amount of money everybody else has, or someone calling you on a favor. How do you juggle those personally? Because I know they have to happen.
You know, they do. And I can't tell you whether I'm successful all the time. There's probably people out there going, you know, the guy just walks past me and doesn't give me the time of day. In fact, it was funny. I was mentioning about Laguna Seca. So early in my day there, I would make a point of going around and checking on all the different committees and then the areas that they were taking care of. And at the end of the season, you know, we would do this sort of survey of the team. And part of it was also a survey of, you know, what was I like to sort of work with? And one of the people, it was an anonymous survey, once he, you know, the trouble is he keeps coming around and checking on us. You know, what's with this? And it's like, okay, so I'm not actually checking on them. I'm checking in with them, but obviously it's coming across the wrong way.
Sure.
And another person comes around and goes, you know, well, he never comes around and checks on us. And then another person said, well, lucky you, keep quiet. So it's all relative. But you're doing that with larger groups. You just have to, you have to try and make an effort all the time, whether it's, and sometimes something comes up and you've got to hurry from one part of an event to another. And somebody wants to stop and talk. So, you know, you have to either, you know, politely excuse yourself or spend a couple of minutes with them. I always try and say, if I can, I'll be back, because I have said, well, you know, I'll come back and find you. And then you get distracted and you don't come back. And then you're worse off. Yeah. Because the person said, what did I do wrong? It is a challenge, but that's just part of what we do in trying to make sure that we put on good events and people have an enjoyable time.
I feel like what you just gave examples of about checking up, that's kind of a microcosm, I think, of just people in general, because I can take that exact same example and apply it to a very traditional corporate America. And one employee is going to say, my boss leaves me alone. They don't care how I'm doing. And the other employee says, my boss won't leave me alone. They're always asking me how I'm doing. You know, it seems to not really matter. People just seem to kind of be wired either one way or the other. And it's an interesting thing. Have you ever lost a relationship behind something within the automotive community, in a sense where maybe you had to make a compromise for an employer or some other event that a colleague or even a friend just didn't understand?
I have, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
It was a decision that I had to make. I was hoping I didn't have to, and it was very tough.
Yeah.
But it is, if you're in, you know, a position of responsibility, whether, you know, the person that makes, you know, all the decisions, or sometimes I put it, it's like, I don't make all the decisions, but if something goes wrong, I seem to be the only person in charge. So yes. And that just happens. You know, I think if you, it's just a matter of time. If it hasn't happened to, you know, anybody that's in a leadership position now, it's just a matter of time. And the busier you are, and I've certainly work for a number of organizations and done a lot of events. And I think, you know, but that being said, I've also had situations where I've had some very challenging initial meetings or relationships or connecting with somebody for the first time on a very challenging situation. And ultimately you end up with very long-term relationships or actually even personal friends. But the first time you meet or interact, you know, is not pretty for whatever reason.
You win some and you lose some. And it's one of those things. It's like you can make everybody happy sometimes, but you can't make everyone happy all the time. So at some point, something's going to happen. And you're right.
Yeah.
Switching gears a little bit, let's talk about the car community, because I think trying to paint the car community as one broad stroke is almost like trying to summarize multiple nations of the world with multiple languages as one type of person. Like, how would you define the car community to you?
Well, you know, the car community, that's sort of a broad phrase, because
absolutely,
you know, you can take, you know, some of these, you know, single mark, you know, clubs, you know, whether it's, you know, Corvette or Camaro or in some of the European, you know, marks and they're the Porsche, and they're close knit. You know, they've obviously got a passion for that model or that manufacturer or that particular era. If it's the, you know, 55, 6, 7 Chevrolets, and that's their main focus. And then you get, you know, other broad categories like the Antique Automobile Club of America, even though the name is Antique Automobile Club, the eras of cars that it was accepted into that, you know, goes from early vintage and veteran cars, you know, all the way through, you know, 50s and 60s. Sort of the hot rod era. I know on the West Coast, the Good Guys organization, mm-hmm. and they've created a, you know, sort of a community, a lot number of states, and it's a very active. People feel like they're part of this, you know, affinity group, and I think that's it. I think people enjoy being part of a group where they've got like-minded interests. Now, like-minded interests, it may just be cars in general, or it may be very specific to, you know, air-cooled Porsche cars and anything in between. So I think it's that, you know, enjoying your passion, but enjoying it with other people.
Yeah, I agree. And it's to the person out there who is not into cars at all the car people are all the same. But even given some of the examples that you stated, I mean, the Porsche Club, the PCA, is they're into the PCA. And if you're not in the PCA, you know, they may not look at you the same. And it's the same thing with some of the lowriders and some of the other things. And I just think it's interesting that, I mean, we're all into it, but it's just different enough. Sometimes there's a lot of division in the car community.
Well, the other side of that is you've got any organization, whether it's in the car world or golf or country clubs or homeowners association, you get a group of people together, that there's always, you know, dissenters in the ranks or people that just don't agree. So, yeah, I think that's just part of it. But yeah, we still enjoy being part of these groups and these associations.
Tim, are you allowed to be you when you're at a lot of these events? Because it seems like you're in a position where you almost have to kind of be guarded and watch everything you say, unless you're surrounded by some of your closest friends that you've accumulated over the last three decades.
Well, I'd like to think I don't have to watch what I say. I hope I just say, you know, the right thing all the time. But I think I, you know, because some of the organizations that I've worked for, I certainly do have to be mindful of the situations I'm in, you know, and how there are certainly some times where I've gone, you know, I could quite easily like jump in that car or jump on that motorcycle and go blast around this facility and go, nah, I can't really do that right now because I'm supposed to, I mean, I'm supposed to sort of set an example as sort of leadership of this organization. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I try to make sure I enjoy myself because invariably I do. I mean, I've been very fortunate that I've had a career that's allowed me to work in areas that I've really enjoyed. Which means if you're working long hours, you're doing it at something you enjoy. The downside is that there's no off switch. You know, sometimes my wife's friends ask her and said, how do you know when Tim's working or not working? Because when he's not working in the car world, you guys are at car events because that's my passion. I'm very fortunate. My wife, you know, also appreciates that. But I am conscious of what, you know, not so much what I do, but just that I suppose I try to make sure that I represent the organization I work for and the position I have in the correct manner.
Sure. You have to be mindful. It's like there has to be sometimes when you're out at an event and you look at a car and you're thinking to yourself, that's god awful, but you can't say it. But when you go inside and you're on the computer or flipping through a magazine, you can stop at a car and say, oh, that's god awful. Which is the human factor, right?
You know, it's one of those things. I remember looking back at the cars I liked when I was younger, and a lot of them I still like, but there's a lot I'm going, what was I thinking back in those days? And you know, from a point of view of, you know, people are passionate about all different cars. And I suppose at a younger age, I probably was critical. I was that person. They're going, oh my gosh, that thing's terrible. There are times when you certainly do look at a car and you go, you know, whoa.
Sure.
You know, you try not to say it out loud. But then there's cars that are, again, that wouldn't be my taste. But then I connect with the owner, and then you get engaged and see what they like in a car.
Sure.
You know, I've got a daughter that, you know, into, you know, she likes unusual cars. And sometimes she'll go to me, Dad, look at that. I'm like, you like that? She goes, yeah, that's great. And I'm going like, do I really know you?
Right.
But we go around, and that's the fun part of it. It's, if we all like the same thing, it would be a boring world. So
some people's
tastes are, yeah, some people's tastes are a little bit way out there.
That's a great response, and it kind of brings up this next question. So what have you seen along as far as the evolution of the automotive car culture? Because things, I mean, there's people who have super negative camber where they're riding on an inch of the tire, which obviously is designed to do that. You know, what are some of the things that you've seen out there that you've struggled to embrace the most? Like, I'm 45 years old, and there's trends that I struggle to understand. Like, there's a thing called the Carolina squat where the pickup truck is literally dragging its bumper, rear bumper on the ground while the front is jacked up. Like, I just don't understand that. You know, what are some things? And I know we embrace it, right? Because the person driving that truck, they're into that. And I respect that they're into that, even though I'm not into it. You know, what are some of the trends you've seen that you just kind of scratch your head? It's like, okay, I mean, if they like it.
I think the really big wheels ones is the one that gets me. You know, the really tall, you know, almost up, I'm on stilts type look. And you know, not the 4x4 with the big mud-slinging tires. Those you understand, you just...
Yep.
Not for me, and you go like, yeah. But
you're going to see a lot of those where you're at. I'm here to tell you.
I know that. That's just one thing. I just look at that and I go, and you know, they've got tires that are, you know, probably thinner than rubber bands, and you know that just has to be the hardest ride in the
hardest
world.
Ride, yeah.
You know, you're going to, especially in the roads in Michigan, as I'm learning very quickly.
Oh, they're awful. They're awful around the Detroit area. There's a few stretches, especially over by the Detroit airport. But you know, I mean, LA's got some pretty ugly roads too.
And we know that's exactly it. It was funny. I went down to the IMSA race in mid Ohio last weekend. You know, you drive down here and you cross the state line into Ohio and you go, ooh, I'm on a billiard table.
Right. Yeah. It's awful. So there's a thing that's going on now with the EPA. So we're going to talk a little bit about this because I think it's affecting everybody in a certain sense. They've been pretty aggressive in the past few years about going after, as they call, emission defeating devices. But not everybody sells emission-defeating devices. But earlier this year, they fined a company in Idaho $3.5 million for infractions over a given time frame. A lot of people are thinking that these aggressive emissions are with the EPA hunt is going to eventually eliminate drag strips and racetracks, things like the Monterey, you know, like the Laguna Historics. You know, it could be a thing of the past. And it doesn't seem to matter what era of vehicle you're into. Tuner shops are afraid to make the things that consumers want for fear of being shut down or fined. You know, what are your thoughts on the overall way that the EPA has been aggressively going after tuner shops manufacturers? Because this doesn't matter if you drive a 1930s vehicle, 50s vehicle, or a 2020 vehicle.
Well, it is concerning. And certainly, you know, you can understand the need for sensible regulations.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're now taking to the point where, so, you know, if you're driving a car on the road, whichever state you're in, you know, that car should comply with whatever the current regulations are for sort of emissions and smog or whatever one wants to call it. But what's happening now is they're taking that and it's spreading off, you know, into, as you say, into the drag strips and events like Laguna Seca. But not only that, but all those other small activities in between.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why think, you know, organizations like, you know, PRI and their parent organizations like SEMA and any other group that's got a body that's trying to address this with, you know, the elected officials, whether it's statewide or nationally, because, you know, the industry or the hobby or however you want to describe it, you know, supports, you know, so much. First of all, it generates so much business. And I think there has to be this correct balance between, you know, what is the correct regulation, where does that regulation need to be applied, and have an understanding of what motorsports is all about, or the enjoyment of the automobile that doesn't infringe on breaking your state regulations. Because obviously it is important that we have, we get rid of sort of anything that affects, you know, greenhouse gases from that point of view. And obviously the automobiles are that. But it is concerning. I was at a conversation just 2 days ago with Jamie Myers from PRI. And that's the one good thing. Well, good thing, there's lots, but that's the one thing, you know, SEMA has
right. Yeah.
That power, you know, because of their size. but all other, some of the other racing organizations and any other collective body that touches the world that we're in, is very important that we address that. Because, you know, if you're not into cars, and you don't have to be madly passionate about cars, if you don't understand it, it's easy for an elected official just to go, oh, well, this looks right, and they stamp it,
yep.
And they go, they don't understand the collateral damage that's caused by something that, you know, and even if they did understand, they meant well, but it wasn't thought a way through it, and how it impacts the larger automotive motorsports and everything to do with the world that people enjoy with cars.
Yeah, I was at a local tuner shop. The owner was walking around. I asked him if he would come on. He's a little shy about coming on to the show. But, I mean, he said they're doing work for a commercial. They're scared of the individuals coming in, like myself, to get stuff done because, I mean, Magnaflow and Borla and all the big names themselves, like production is almost halted on their research on these things. And the EPA isn't coming in and saying, hey, beginning on June 5th of 2021, no more. They're saying, give me your books. Stop what you're doing. We're going to go through and we're going to fine you for every infraction and then we'll talk. And it's scaring the heck out of some of these smaller businesses.
Yeah, that's so wrong. It's really not the way to approach
yeah.
it. And I hope they get that, you know, corrected. You know, we all, I suppose we all have our own versions of how we perceive bureaucracy at different levels. But that just seems a case of where it's really gone way off the rails.
Yeah. Let's flip this around and get you out of here on a couple of fun things. There's times, at least I know, where you kind of look back and you miss a certain feeling. Like maybe that first time you saw a car where it's like, oh, wow, I got to have that car. Like for me, the first time I saw a McLaren F1 or a Vector, it's that feeling. Like what's something you look back and miss, even though it's gone and it's okay that it's gone, but you still kind of look back. It's like, man, wow, I missed that.
Probably the high-pitched roar of V12 and V10 Formula One engines. We look back, and at that time, race car engines were just loud. but it was a sound. It wasn't a noise. You know, they made this mm-hmm. wonderful sound. And in the era of the Cosworth V8, where nearly all the F1 teams, you know, that was, they were all using, there was Ferrari obviously had their own engine. The Renault team had their turbo, which made a different sound. In the world of sports cars, I will say, not in the world of sports cars, in the world of race cars, I truly believe the Matra engine for those cars that they raced in Le Mans in the 70s is probably one of the best sounding engines. And I know the Ferrari guys will be going, oh, what does he know? But Ferrari engines sound great. But boy, a Matra Le Mans sports car at full song is a wonderful thing. But I think that V12, V10 era in Formula One, as ear-splitting as it was, you know, that's a certain – they missed that. I wouldn't say I missed it, but the first time I heard it, it made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, was listening to one of the Auto Union Grand Prix cars. So that would be a V16 being driven around the streets of the Monaco circuit by Jackie Ickx. This probably would be five or six years ago. It was at one of the Monaco historics. You know, he wasn't racing it. It was just demonstration laps. But because there's certain parts of the circuit where, you know, he can push on it, you know, when you go through, you know, what they call the Sandoval curve, and they go up the hill mm-hmm. to Casino mm-hmm. Square. So, you know, the engine's under load. And because the building's so close, that was magical. That was a great sound. I can't imagine what it was like in the day when you had, you know, what they call the era of the silver arrows. You had the Mercedes Grand Prix cars and the Auto Union Grand Prix cars, and they were duking it out. That just had to be something special.
Have you ever gone to the WeatherTech International Historics up in Elkhart Lake?
I have not. I hope to. Now I'm a lot closer.
You're a lot
I
closer.
I went to. They used to be, was formerly called the Chicago Historics. It was held at Elkhart Lake, and it was put on by a chap from Chicago by the name of Joe Marchetti. I didn't know Joe that well, but when I worked for Rick Cole, he and Joe were really good friends. And Joe was another one. He was a consummate hospitality person. He owned a restaurant in the Chicago area called Como Inn. But you went to the races because Joe took care of everybody. So I'd been to historic races up there at that time, obviously been to some IMSA races. recently, but I hope to go to the WeatherTech Challenge. I mean, the WeatherTech Historics up there. The guys up there I got to know very well through my time at Laguna Seca, Mike Kirchner and his team. Mm-hmm. And it's a great track. And Siebkins in Elkhart Lake is also a place that
you have to get there. You have to get there. I've been there a few times. You have to get there. That super famous painting that they have with all the racers that have come in there.
One year we were there, they have that, you know, where you drive your race car from the track and they have the car show downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And then later in the evening, they all drive back. I'd ridden with Rick. He had a Lotus 23B. And, you know, Rick's smaller in stature. I stand 6 foot tall. So, you know, sitting in a little car like that, I'm like a cartoon character sticking out. So, you know, we drove in the parade. I think it was police escorted downtown. And but then we went to dinner, spent some time with friends. By the time it was over, not only had the rest of the cars gone, but it was now dark. And, you know, we're trying to make our way back to the track in a race car with no lights along the old roads. That was that was an interesting trip.
I'm familiar with that route. I led a few parade laps around the historic Road America course that goes through downtown Elkhart Lake. And I'm very familiar with that. What's left on the Tim McCrane wish list of events to either attend or be a large part of organizationally?
I think I'm going to have my hands full as regards events to organize. I think what we've got here, and we're going to start putting together a 3 to 5 year plan for the events that we have, you know, sort of theming them, looking down the road and going, okay, how can we make this one a little bit special that year because there's an anniversary or there's somebody we're going to recognize. I think we're going to, you know, look to, you know, create another feature event. We'll find the time on our calendar and obviously the other calendars out there and see if we can find an opening. Not sure what that will be, but certainly we'll have a combination of an automotive theme and a lifestyle theme here. So we'll work on that. I've never been to Monza. And I think that just the passion that Italians have, I think, you know, there's certainly a number of F1 tracks, historic tracks I haven't been to, but I think Monza would have to be up there. You'd actually have to do that. I've never done the London to Brighton. I've watched it when I was a lot younger, and it wasn't quite as well supported. You know, there was a period of time where, you know, you had fathers or grandfathers that had the car and the younger generation weren't coming around. And actually, I think it's generally thought of that there's a film called Genevieve, which is a British film. It was based around the London to Brighton, and the film became very, very popular in England and was probably responsible for the turnaround of people interested in the London to Brighton. So, you know, that's event going on. I've had a lot of friends that participate. I have some friends that have been involved with it. Given that the cutoff for the cars is 1904, you can't have anything younger than 1904. And boy, not only are they strict about that, but the verification process that the car has to go through to actually make sure that it is a true 1904 car, and you know, from that point of view. But the numbers of cars that participate, you know, growing each year, and the average age of the participant is going down. So you're
Which
getting
is good.
Young. Yeah, that's exactly it. Now, this is an exceptional event, but it's wonderful that that's the case. And, you know, because, you know, that still keeps the legacy of those, you know, pre-turn of the century. I mean, in a few years ago, I heard that they thought that the numbers were going down. Maybe it went down for a couple of years. And they thought, well, let's increase it by 2 years. You know, we'll make it 1906. Or maybe it was 1 year. And oh my gosh, the uproar from the people that participated that they were going to change it. And they were very adamant about it. They were like, no, it's never going to happen. And the anniversary is based around, you know, the changing of the rules in England. Mm-hmm. It was called the Red Flag Act. You know, they got away with the act that required if you had a car that a man had to walk in front of your car with a red flag to warn everybody that this monstrous car, automobile was coming down the road. And the start of the London to Brighton, you know, was to recognize that. So, they're very passionate about it. That a car, for, an event, and what it's also done, it's made those cars so much more valuable. I mean, you can take a, you know, a 1904 car and its sister 1905, and you could potentially have double, triple, or sometimes 10 times the value in the cars because it's eligible to qualify for the London to Brighton run.
Wow. Well, you know, I understand that. I mean, as each year passes, it seems like more of those cars may potentially drop off. You know, the participant bank is going to get smaller.
Yeah.
One more question for you. You've heard this question all sorts of various ways, so I'm sure, but I have a little spin for you at the end. So the world is ending tomorrow. You've done everything you've committed to do. Everyone in your life has given you permission to do this. What car are you taking on your last drive and why? And you cannot take the 1959 Aston Martin DBR1.
So do I know if it's a long drive, a short drive, a fast drive, or?
It can be as long as you want because it's got to make it. Throw comfort out the window.
You know, I tell you what would be a special ride. I'd seen it a number of times statically. And when I was at the Black Hawk Museum, we were fortunate enough to have the car as part of an exhibit and I got to ride in it. And it's the 53 LeSabre, the styling car that Harley Earl did for General Motors. The Bill Mitchell car. It is a stunning design. The car in its day, technology-wise, was certainly revolutionary. I would say that would be it. I would say just give me enough time to get cross-country at a leisurely pace.
So kind of comfort. I'm looking at one right now, or one I believe is it.
It's blue. It's a lighter blue. It's got that circle distinctive in the front. Oval. And, yep, and that actually rotates to 180 degrees, and there's two headlights in that.
What?
So that spins around. That oval spins around, and that's where the lights are. It was actually probably the original flex fuel car because in the back there's one tank to take gasoline and one tank to take ethanol. It's a pretty special car, but styling wise, it just looks wonderful. Yeah, that would be a ride.
Wow, I did not know that. As far as ethanol, and people think this is a new thing, and I talked about this on an older show.
Yeah,
they've been trying to do EV vehicles for ages as well. It's just now like a big thing, you know? Yeah. So if you want to get a hold of the adventures of Tim McGrane, how do they get a hold of you?
I spend a lot of time at M1 Concourse. So on our m1concourse.com website and our Facebook page, there we just keep up with what we've got going here. And, you know, so, you know, for people who are interested either in the area or making a road trip, you know, sort of come by. Now, I should say back onto the LeSabre. So the LeSabre, and I think the exhibit is still going on, at the Detroit Institute of Arts, they are having an exhibit, and the exact title of the exhibit slips my mind at the moment, but the LeSabre is part of that. It's a pretty stunning selection of cars, you know, again, the past, present, and future, different styling. Obviously, being at the Detroit Institute of Arts, it's all about sort of the art of the automobile. But if you're in the area, it's well worth stopping by. And then, you know, obviously, if we're making a car stop, you have to go to the Henry Ford, go to the Detroit Institute of Art. And if we've got a car activity going on at M1 Concourse, stop by here.
Awesome. Thank you so much for spending the time with me. It's been a big pleasure.
Jay, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
That conversation was and still is brought to you by The Cell Shop, an Arizona-based retailer that strives to be a destination of your choice for wireless services, whether Arizona, Washington State, California, Texas, and Florida. They're an authorized AT&T dealer, so visit them at cellshop.us and get connected today. That interview was from 2021. Like I said, I ran into Tim McGrane at Long Beach, which is really cool. He gave me an M1 Concourse book. Took a couple photos with him, and hopefully one day I'll make it up to Michigan to do the M1 Concourse and the Woodward Dream Cruise. Also, I'll be back next week in studio. I want to thank Ray Honda and Ray Toyota for OilAlign.com, Cell Shop Wireless Services, AutoCannon, officially licensed Honda and Acura gear. They have some new stuff that should be delivered to you guys soon. I'll be supporting that. Patreon biz supporter, Koya Automotive out of Warren Garden, Florida, Automotive Specialty Tools out of Orange Hills, Maryland, Pell Construction off Caledonia, Michigan, Big House Small Home Design out of Ashburg, Virginia, and Traverse City, Michigan. Shipping success with West Tankersley out of Boise, Idaho. If you're interested in helping the podcast upgrade, you can join my Patreon for a little $3 a month. Get access to bonus audio, video, and some show swag. Shout out to Mark Stoneman, Catherine Cox, A. Ramos, Richard Graves, Byron Jones, Bo Jones, Alice Comina, Drew Buckley, and Yasser Chiba. Email the show, hardparkingpodcast@gmail.com. Follow me on Instagram @jfinney. Follow me on TikTok @hardparkingj. Join the Hard Parking Violations Facebook group. And remember, I can't grow without you telling the world how great this show is. Let's do this. Let's grow this thing together. And for real, I'll talk to you next week.
Shut up!